Okay, hello everyone. We will bring the July 9th, 2007 meeting of the City Council to order. We have one member absent. Rick Grantham had surgery and is watching from home. The other member, I'm hoping, will still show up while we go through our beginning processes. So we'll begin tonight with a moment of silence. Thank you. There she is. Okay. To lead the pledge, let the record show that four of us are now present. To lead the pledge tonight, we have two people, our new principal from Del Mar, Janet Gould, and a young lady who's going into the fifth grade at Del Mar School, Natalie Esposa. So would you two please come up and lead us in the pledge, Natalie?
Put your right hand over your heart. Ready? Begin. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Yeah, you can't get away that quick, Natalie. Okay, you're going to go into fifth grade. Can you tell us a little bit about what do you like best about school? What's your favorite subject?
Fluency Lab.
Which is it?
Fluency Lab.
Okay. And what are you going to do this summer?
Swimming.
You're going to be spending it with friends? And where are you going to go swimming? In the ocean?
In Cayucas,
okay. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Natalie. Good luck next year and have a great summer. And then also, our new principal, would you like to say anything?
I just wanted to introduce myself, Janet Gould. I'm a Morro Bay resident, and I've been a teacher here in Morro Bay for 11 years. So this is an exciting new job for me, and I look forward to the position, and I would encourage all of you to come and visit our schools, and we're always looking for volunteers as well. So please come by.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We love having the kids come and lead the pledge, ready to go. And we will hopefully have it televised. I'm working on that. We'll see if AGP has a crew available. And hope you can come. It's from 10 till noon at the library this Saturday. Just to let you know, our second meeting in July is canceled. It's a vacation time. We even get one. So our next meeting after tonight will be August 13th. And other announcements. Oh, Dylan's not here. Our city engineer just had a baby, and so I was going to congratulate him on his second son. Susan Slayton has been with us for a year, which is amazing how time flies. Very glad to have had you. Another announcement, the trolley routes are now viewable through the website. Janine has set that up. So if you're concerned about visitors coming or you want to take a ride on the trolley, check the website and you can find out where and when to catch it. The Harbor Walk. Coastal Commission staff finally informed us that they've approved our recent submittals, and we expect contractor operations to begin on the site this week. Hooray, hooray. That's a good one. Just in case any of you noticed a big bang at the power plant last week, something went to ground in the switchyard. That's the explanation we got, and it caused the safety systems to trip as designed. And it was quite loud, but it was perfectly effective in the way it was supposed to work. It was just a little startling to hear. There was also, at the same time, a strong smell of natural gas in the area of the bike path and Highway 1, and that's where the pressure relief valve is, and it vented to the atmosphere, but it was perfectly, again, normal and safe. That's what it's supposed to do. So if anyone had concerns about that, that's what that was all about. 4th of July. Well, it was a great party, but it was a little foggy for fireworks. So we'll try and do better next year, but the bathrooms were open, so that was good. Let's see. That's all for me. Betty?
If anyone's interested in how the Coastal Commission operates or works, they're in town in San Luis Obispo this week. Their meetings are Wednesday, through Friday at the Embassy Suites. They begin around 8 o'clock and go as long as 5 or later. There is an open reception at Eco Slow on the corner of Napomo and Marsh Street, catty corner from Foster Freeze in San Luis, between 5 and 7, I believe, no, 6 and 8, Tuesday night, if anyone would like to come and meet the commissioners. The city is also having a reception with the commissioners on Thursday, but it's on a boat, so I think seating's limited.
Yeah. Pull up, as a matter of fact. Bill?
Nothing.
What about the radio thing?
Okay, yes, I guess I can mention that. If anyone, I guess the last weekend in June noticed, especially in the middle of the night, a pop-up tent down at Tidelands Park. That was a group of amateur radio operators which function as an emergency communications group for the city in the event the big one comes and clears everything else out. And they annually do participate in, it's called a field day. It's a competition where people all over the place try to make as many contacts as far away as they can. And sitting down at Tidelands Park with their homemade antennas, they managed to make 150-some-odd contacts in 19 different states and two Canadian provinces.
Pictures. So as I approached them, I said, sure, put my hand out. And one of them in the back said, don't put the pollution in the background. And so I said, well, what do you mean? And they said, oh, don't talk about it. I said, no, really, I'm on the city council, and I'd like to know what you're saying about the town. And they said, oh, we're really sorry. They didn't want to offend. And I said, please, just point to it. Just point to it, okay? And they pointed at the power plant, of course. And that goes along with my feelings about something to do with power plants and tourists. So we turned around and we put the rock behind them. The second thing, probably more important for all of us, is that we all need to be more aware and conscious about things that are going down in the storm drains, things that are happening with our collection system. I was walking along on Napa Street with a friend of mine, and I saw a drain cover there, and it was just bubbling up over. It's not supposed to do that. See, the water was bubbling up, had some soap on it, down into the drain, into the storm drain, which, as you all know, goes into the bay. Not good. So I asked staff for a couple of phone numbers, should you see any of these, because I will say staff responded immediately, and they did find a clogged drain, and they had the big truck out there pumping it out and cleaning it up, and nothing got into the bay as a result of that very fast action. So if you ever see something like that somewhere, please call 772-6261. And if it's after hours or on the weekends, please call the police at 772-6225. They know the call-out numbers. Staff does say, please do not call 911 because most of those calls go to the CHP on the weekend and they don't care about our sewer. I think the only other thing I'd probably mention is I see where the August meetings are, and it's a long time till August, and so I'll just say that I have a grandbaby due in between those two August meetings, so if I'm not here on one of those meetings, that's most likely the reason I'm holding a new grandchild. Thank you.
That's exciting. Okay. For our shop local tonight, we have Gio from Giovanni's Fish Market. Come on up. Tell us a little bit about what our citizens should know about where to buy fish.
Hi, my name is Giovanni from Giovanni's Fish Market, located on the Embarcadero here in Morro Bay. A few things that you may or may not know about us. Giovanni's is the oldest fish market in Morro Bay. My family bought it from the Brebs family in 1985, and it was a fish market before that. I believe at least in the 70s and possibly back to the 60s. We also, which some of you may or may not know, operate the oldest marine fuel and ice dock here in town. We supply fuel and ice to the fishermen, and that dock has been doing so consecutively since the 60s as well. So we like to deal with the fishermen directly, and we think that's what gives us a competitive edge in making sure that we have really fresh fish. So what we try to do is we specialize in local fresh seafood whenever possible. However, many of you know that with lots of regulations and cutbacks in the fishing industry due to state, federal regulations, and so on and so forth, It's increasingly difficult to get fresh fish locally. However, all those fish tacos, Dungeness crab quesadillas, and we've won the chowder cook-off for the last couple of years in a row, so we're pretty happy about that, and we're definitely hoping for a three-peat this year. To accommodate that long line, we are in the process of dealing with the planning and building department as well as the fire department, and I think we're just about wrapped up with our plans, and we should be able to start construction on our new kitchen, which will be able to accommodate people a little bit faster starting in fall to winter. So we're very excited about that. We've outgrown our kitchen that's been there since 1985 and realized that the demand for fish and chips has gotten to be pretty big. So we're very excited about that. Another point that I would like to tell some of the locals, if you're afraid of that big line and afraid of the tourists, but you want to have some really good food, you can always call in your order, 772-2123, and then you don't have to wait in line. You can just come in the fish market, cut in line in front of everybody, and say, I'm here to get my order. So just don't mind the dirty looks from all the tourists as you walk inside. But a little secret just for our locals. So just give us a call, and we'll have your order ready.
Your specials.
Specials, yes, and discounts for locals, too. That's what I was going to tell you. Something else that you may or may not know, and hopefully you do. If you don't, you'll be happy that I'm telling you now. 10% off on Tuesdays for all senior citizens, 55 years of age and older. We've been doing that for about 25 years as well. So if you didn't know that, that's something to know. With the ever-rising cost of seafood, we can get it, but it's getting much, much more expensive than it used to be. So to help curb that, we've always offered a senior discount, 10% off on Tuesdays, and that's if you're 55 or older. And if you're local and smile really big, we might give it to you anyway if you're 54. So in addition to that, we have a new program. We just started our website this year. We jumped into the 21st century and went internet, and that's www.giovannisfishmarket.com. And there you can sign up for our coupon list, and we'll actually send you out a new coupon every month. And a lot of people, we've seen an overwhelming response. We have well over 1,000 people on our list now that are mostly local, and they come up and say, we're ready for the coupon, and it actually comes out once a month. We don't send you any spam. We don't sell your names to anybody. We just send you a coupon, again, to help curb the ever-rising cost of fish. So we think that's something that we want to help you out with. And fish is a great source of protein. It's lean. It's good for you. You know, if you eat fish and seafood high in omega-3, you're actually half as likely to have a heart attack. So, hey, I think that's something great. And men are 40% less likely to get advanced prostate cancer by eating fish and seafood at least twice a week. So it's healthy. It's good. It supports the local economy. We try to help out the local fishermen and just be a really integral part of that. Whether we're selling the fishermen fuel and ice or unloading their catch or selling it in the fish market, my family's been here for a long time, and I hope to be here for a long time more. I would like to give credit where credit's due, and that's to my father, Mike DeGaramore, who was an abalone diver here in the 60s and 70s, and he started all of this. We actually started our first fish market in Morro Bay in 1973. That was the Finicky Fish Number 2, and that's where I was actually brought when I was one day old. I had a wooden fish box for a crate in the back, and that's now the tie boat, if you don't know where that's at. That was the Finicky Fish for many years. We operated that for 30 years. As well as our wholesale plant that my brothers run in Atascadero, that's Central Coast Seafoods. So my father's since retired, and he's enjoying retirement on the Siletz River in Oregon, fishing daily in his backyard. So that's all about me and my family. Thank you.
Thank you.
Four fire agencies and 40 firefighters that will be involved in training in the morning will be doing various scenarios with fire, live fire training, and ventilation training, and a myriad of things that we'll do up until about 12 or 12:30, and we plan to do the final burn down in the afternoon. So if you'd like to witness that, I'm sure there will be room over in the park. However, we won't have people right in the immediate area around the building. That'll be a safety zone, and we'll exclude the public from that immediate area.
And Harbor Street's going to be closed Saturday,
correct.
Right?
Correct. Harbor Street will be closed from Piney to Morro Bay Boulevard. That's the 700 block of Harbor Street. Thank you. And those 72-hour notifications will be going up along the street Tuesday night, tomorrow night. Let's see. Additionally, we're putting the color coat this week on the station out at Station 54 on Bonita Street. There's how it looked a week ago. So we're making progress there. Diani Construction is telling us it could be finished in as early as 2 weeks from now. So we're excited about having that completed and being able to put our vehicles back inside. Let's see here. Fire weather. Just a quick mention. Tonight, actually midnight through Tuesday evening, Wednesday morning, there's a threat of dry thunderstorms. So the fire threat from the electricity from the lightning can ignite quite a few fires. The Inyo fire that's burning right now was started that way. Back when we had the Las Palitas fire, we had 300 lightning strikes from dry lightning in one day. So it can be a hazardous time, so we'll be looking out for that in the next 24 to 36 hours. It could turn into a little bit of moisture later on, but the first 12 to 24 hours, they're looking at dry lightning. And with that, I'll stop right there. Have a good meeting.
Thank you. Okay, we didn't have a closed session. However, there was a Planning Commission meeting last week, and there was some talk about the major vegetation item. I think there may be some people here wanting to talk to that, so I asked Rob to explain what the issue is that we have before us tonight versus what people might think it's about.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'll give another announcement before I even give that one. I've just realizing going over our agenda, B3 is our ordinance regarding construction hours. And if you look at the agenda on our agenda, it says amendment of Chapter 12 when the amendment is really in Chapter 9. So we're going to have to continue that item for the construction hours because it's not noticed properly.
Okay.
So that one will have to be noticed. I'm sorry, just a mix up. We probably thought it was in somehow in Chapter 12 earlier on, but it is an amendment. My report is correct, and that has the right announcement for it, but not the actual agenda, so we'll have to continue that one. Okay. As to item, I believe you're talking about C1 and C2. There's two items tonight related to trees and the removal of trees. C1 is an amendment to our municipal code regarding city trees in our city right-of-ways, and that amendment, if passed by council, it's gone through first reading, is now on second reading. And if that is passed by council, then no city trees can be trimmed or removed during the nesting season, which is February to July. I don't believe this one is very controversial. The only thing that I brought up in that is that there could be a cost increase in trying to, if major vegetation is to be removed. However, the Coastal Act fails to define what is major vegetation, and that's what we've been trying to do since 95. Why isn't there a definition of major vegetation in the Coastal Act, or why haven't other jurisdictions dealt with this issue? Well, over 10 years ago, we researched this, and I've come across the memos. In fact, the answer is because no other jurisdiction utilizes the Coastal Act for this type of regulation. If you're going to regulate private trees, then you do it through an ordinance. You don't do it through guidelines. C2 is now adding another section, which can be controversial because it will not allow any tree to be removed on private property from February to July. So I came across my memo in 95, and I'll just quote again on that issue. We are using the wrong mechanism to accomplish the regulation of cutting of private trees. Probably the most efficient mechanism to use will be a private tree ordinance in whatever shape or form the council wishes to enact. I therefore recommend that we change the focus of the project from regulation of major vegetation under the Coastal Act to a private tree ordinance. And I've said that over and over, and I still think our focus shouldn't be on guidelines for major vegetation because that has to do with coastal development permits and when you issue a coastal development permit. It's not a guideline. It's not where you prohibit or mandate someone to do or not to do something. That should be in a private tree ordinance. So, again, I urge you to focus it on the private tree ordinance. I know that's on our agenda list to be done. I don't know where it is. That would be planning on where they are with that. So the issue is C2 is a more controversial one because it deals with private trees, and it does deal with regulating the removal of that. But again, it's only a guideline, and from a mechanism standpoint, drives staff crazy.
Okay, so just I wanted that explanation because I know some of you may be here as a follow-up to that Planning Commission meeting, which I watched the other night, and I just wanted you aware of the technical differences between a tree ordinance, which we have on our to-do list, and these regulations. So you're still welcome to speak on it, but I wanted to clarify that for what we're doing tonight. It's not working on a tree ordinance yet, but will. All right. With that, we will begin public comment.
please limit your comments to 3 minutes and things that are not on our public hearing agenda.
Good evening, Mayor, Council, staff. My name is Keith Taylor, resident of Morro Bay, friend of the Morro Bay Fire Department. I'm here tonight to speak about the successful Morro Bay Fire Muster. And I'd like to thank all the sponsors and all the people that donated things for the raffle. And the mayor donated artwork, which I didn't thank her for, so I say thank you now. And the community for really coming out and supporting this. Well, after everything was said and done, we're going to be able to give $1,500 to the Ann Roush Burn Foundation for the Youth Summit, which is for our county. So that's really a really neat thing, and I just wanted to report on that. We're all excited about maybe being able to have it next year, and we think we're going to get it. Thank you very much.
I can go then, I guess.
Okay, because it would be appropriate to save your comments for that discussion.
Okay.
Okay,
fine.
Thank you.
Is this a good time to say something on behalf of the trees?
Okay.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Just a few brief points here.
We need your name first.
All right. Dan Connect.
Okay.
Shasta Street. Basically, I guess how it was presented to me is that his one of the main reasons for taking out the trees would be that he doesn't like the odor they emit. And that is his opinion. He's entitled to that, but that's exactly that, an opinion. It's subjective. I'd like to take a step back here and just look at some objective truths about the situation at hand. The trees haven't posed a problem for what I would guess well over 100 years, judging by their size, maybe 200, I don't know, ever since the rail companies brought them over, however long ago that was, but it's been generations, and you know they're still there for probably pretty good reasons, I'd imagine. Another is the ecosystems. They are homes to the owls, the falcons, the insects they eat, everything, microscopic to macroscopic, living ecosystems that contribute to the air we breathe as well, so it gets from the ground up literally there. They're a sun and wind barrier for the field. They'll help cut winds for throwing discs, playing frisbee, you know. Good shade for the dogs and the soccer players on those hot days, you know, go chill out under the trees. They're beautiful. They're landmarks, like we all know. I say, yeah, come to my house. It's the one right across the street from the field with the gigantic trees, you know. Not pretty hard to miss. It's a landmark. So, I mean, pretty much if we do the right thing here, I think that we can look at this as somewhat of a blessing. You know, we've been given a chance. That chance is, I'm going to kind of throw out a cliche here, but we don't have to make it a cliche if we do the right thing. We have a chance to think global and act local. And if we make the right decisions here on this situation, we can really start here. And if more people around the world and in different communities started here, well, we can make a big change, I believe. So, you know, go somewhere else to cut. You want to go cut down big trees. I know this nice country down in South America, Brazil. It's going on all over the place down there. Check it out, you know. Take it out of Morro Bay. Kick rocks. Beat it. We have this choice to stand up to our own kind of microcosmic form of big business ideals here. The only reason to take out these trees would be for business. And that's a pretty – it's a bad reason to use polite diction there. Let's keep them. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, no applause, please. Waving hands is great, but we're not going to get into applause because that leads to other expressions of opinions.
My name is Dorothy Cutter, and I'm going to read this. This is in reference to lease site number 34W at 225 Main Street. I'm asking you not to extend this lease, but follow Morro Bay precedent and write a new lease that addresses all the problems at this lease site. Hold a public hearing before renewing this. This site has 3 residences and 4 boat slips and just 1 car garage, which partly extends onto the city senate is, and cars cannot park on the street. The overflow residential parking from 225 Main Street is also across the street at a different location than the boat slip parking. The carrot held up to the council to grant this extension is a promise to extend marina facilities in this area. If the staff would do their homework and look into the history of past intentions to expand marina facilities, they would discover that the state and federal government won't allow development of this kind in this area. The city needs to consider either in-lieu parking fees or hold the developer accountable to provide all the spaces necessary for this location. One solution for him is for him to buy the vacant lot next to 225 Main Street that can be turned into a parking lot. He should not be allowed to park all over the public walkways and in front of other people's property. And I'd like to have this on the record.
Okay, thank you. Next.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of the council. My name's Candy Bowditch. I'm going to address the same issue. I own and live at 206 Main Street. Tonight I wish to address item D5 under unfinished business on the agenda, the proposed 10-year extension of the waterfront lease number 34W, currently owned by Norm Arnold. I mailed a packet to all the city council and the planners and the Coastal Commission explaining in detail more some of the issues regarding the parking area that's located on my property. The arrangement's a mistake. I think when Gladys owned it, it probably made more sense because she owned both properties. But it's very dangerous with the amount of traffic and such that we have going by there, and the liability is just very large. The four boat slips on the number 34 water lease are tied to my five parking spaces. The deed restriction says that I have to maintain them or until redevelopment of the waterfront parcel provides for five parking spaces. I assert that this redevelopment is taking place now. If you see all the heavy equipment over there and all the building that's going on, it's pretty extensive. Norm has repeatedly told Kevin and me that he plans to provide his own parking, but he tells others that he owns my parking lot. Of course, I had the property surveyed, and he doesn't. He's redeveloped extensively, adding more structures that are now livable. According to the staff report dated 7207 from Rick Algert, Norm plans to explore concepts for expanding or improving slips, but is 2 years away from submitting plans. He's not yet redone the main house, Glad's Castle, and as Dorothy pointed out, there's only one parking space. That me being the owner of 206 is going to bear the financial burden for an overdevelopment at 225. And then there's zoning changes, manufacturing versus residential, nuisance issues, maintenance issues, visual impact. As a condition of granting the 10-year extension to the number 34 water lease, you could include that he provide his own parking or pay in lieu fees, as are done on the Embarcadero. You have the ability to fix a potentially damaging and dangerous problem tonight. Please give the matter serious consideration, and please help me. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Council, Mayor Linda Merrill, Morro Bay. I'm coming to you this evening because of my concern for the Morro Bay Golf Course. I'm sure that most of you have read an article or some of the articles about this beautiful golf course, and it's drying up. And the reason is that there's a broken pipe, which arguably should have been taken care of years ago, but the crisis is now. And I would like to ask this council to consider helping with the situation. If you can have someone contact the county, supervisors. They need to really spend the money. And also, we need to spend the money because this is a revenue source. People come, as we all know, to play golf at that course from all over the world, all over the country. So it is an asset. It's a beautiful golf course, and I really do think that it would be a financial investment if you just don't love it for its beauty because it's open space and all the trees and all of that. I think that we could look at it from a financial standpoint. If you can help in any way to assist the county, whether we have water that we can negotiate with them about or provide them on a short-term basis or something like that. But this is really serious. You know, the fairways are drying up. The greens are in jeopardy. You know, everything about the golf course is in jeopardy. So please, I know it's a county lease course. I know it's a state-owned course. But everybody refers to it as the Morro Bay Golf Course. So please, council, consider helping with this crisis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen of the council. I would, first of all, like to give you my appreciation for being able to attend this meeting. My name is Gary Freeman. I'm a bit of a new player in the city here. We just bought property the last month here, moving back from overseas. I live at 224 Main Street, across from the 225 issue, which is daytime as well as all day long with construction people coming in and out. It is Palm Street runs right in front off of Main Street from 224, and at this point in time, it has a roadblock at the end of the street stopping it from going on up further to Main. So people tend to kind of use that as a dead-end cul-de-sac now. And over the last month being there, we are seeing the traffic and the cars accelerating, and there's a growth rate of people now coming in, all to do with the 225 issue across the street. What we're also seeing is the people that are using the boat slips and parking their cars there, going in late at night, are using our trash facilities to dump all the trash. And we're getting all these doggy bags and everything put in there. So it's becoming quite a public park in front of a private house. And for us, it's a real concern because we certainly didn't think we were going to buy into this type of a situation. And I think now it's getting quite political from talking to everybody and all the issues there. So, again, I will reiterate what Dorothy has said. Originally, Norm Arnold had a property with on the far side that he sold off, and it would have been quite useful for helping parking facilities for the three houses he's now developing there, and also for a boathouse that's down below that has no parking, and his little lighthouse there. And why he sold that off and didn't use it for parking, I don't know, because he doesn't have sufficient parking for his own houses, let alone for the boat people. So before this lease of the boat comes through, I think it should be paramount that we look into actually what his plans are for parking and how is he going to handle all these people, because it's certainly causing a problem for us already, and it hasn't even got started. And that's the main issue. And it's also a safety issue, too, because we're seeing now people trying to cross the street of Main Street, which has no parking facilities on our side. There's no sidewalks, nothing. And they're dodging traffic trying to get across all the time. And it's quite a fast street there. So the more people that are using that, okay, the more parking is becoming an issue.
Okay, I have to ask you to wrap it up because the buzzer rang.
Okay, well, that's all. That's all I've got to say. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
My name is Joan Solu, and I've come here tonight to thank in public some people who helped put together what was called the Ride of a Lifetime on the last day of school at Del Mar. In April, Del Mar Elementary School had its first auction and fundraiser, and some parents got together and they bid on kind of a goofy idea billed as the right of a lifetime. Three families got together and they bid $500 for this kind of kooky, nutty idea. And on the last day of school, it took place, and the winning class was a sixth grade class, Mr. Reed's sixth grade class, so it was going to be their final day of school. They met at Triangle Park, and they had a meet and greet with Mayor Peters, Councilwoman Winholtz, Councilmember Grantham was there. Our esteemed police and fire chiefs were there, and we got some pictures taken, but we felt like the trolley wasn't good enough, and our wonderful police chief said, "Hey." "Why don't you hop on up?" So they went crazy for that. I mean, they were running over there. They climbed in and out of the police cars, all over the fire trucks. I mean, they were everywhere. It was a mad scramble. So we got a bunch of really great pictures taken, and one of these, the trolley is for the city hall, and the fire one is for the fire department, and we are eternally grateful. From Del Mar PTA, we were able to raise $500 with that one single bid. And I have to say, the trolley rental was $250, and we are eternally grateful to Mayor Peters for using her discretionary funds to foot that bill. And we are grateful to the White Caps, who greeted us with the entire student body out on the lawn. The kids deboarded the trolley, and the White Caps played the graduation march, and they were high-fiving all the kindergartners and everybody out there. So it was really great, and I would like to again thank the Franzman family, the Rodriguez family, and the Franklin family for purchasing that. Thank you.
And thank you for setting that all up. That was a great event.
Ms. Mayor, Honorable Council, Bill Woodson, resident. Maybe I'm barking up the wrong tree on this, but I want to talk a little bit about C2. With all due respect to our esteemed city attorney, Rob Schultz, this issue seems to me walks like a tree ordinance and flies like a tree ordinance and quacks like a tree ordinance. So I have some suggestions concerning this resolution. I think that we have to ask ourselves, are we really a tree city? Are we really a bird sanctuary? And I wanted to bring your attention to a recent Time magazine issue, July 2nd, and it addresses urban deforestation, and it says something to the effect, a big tree does 60 to 70 times the pollution removal of a small tree. And then it goes on to say, local governments are finally responding to the problem. More than 2,000 big and small cities have launched long-term planting and preservation programs. And even Los Angeles, of which I'm from, is planning on planting over 1 million trees in the next 30 years, of which they've already planted over 100,000. So I hope, even though your private tree ordinance is on your list, I hope it is very high on your list, and I have some suggested wording for your ordinance, and it can start like something like this. No 6-inch diameter or higher diameter tree shall be removed without a public hearing and city council approval. I could go on and I could say no exceptions. I could go on and say something to the effect that on fines and penalties, that if a tree is removed.
Madam Mayor, members of the council, my name is Roger Ewing. I'm a Morro Bay resident, citizen. I was prepared to talk about another subject, but upon looking at the agenda and seeing some of the folks here, I think the subject C2 is far more important than what I was originally going to speak on. I'm very much in favor of a private tree ordinance, although that's not what you're addressing tonight. You're addressing a resolution, which is a nice first step, but that's all it is the first step. So we need to create the impetus and the follow-through. That's what you're here for tonight, to start the process. Because as Mr. Woodson said, if we are a tree city, then we need to value our trees. And I tend to want to value our trees because they are not only trees and beautiful to look at, but they create habitats. And they form our identity and our character for the whole community. And unless we place trees as an important priority, we are going to lose them. Development in the last 10 years has shown that. We've lost a major portion of our large growth trees. And it's our large growth trees, our landmark trees, our heritage trees that create the habitats, that give us the birds that we appreciate, etc. So somewhere in this resolution you're drawing up tonight, I would hope that you would add an amendment to protect landmark trees. Any tree over 25 or 35 feet will need a CDP, a conditional use permit, and go before the Planning Commission and or the Council. We need to begin now to protect our trees, or we're not going to have anything left to protect. So thank you for listening. Thank you for putting this on the agenda. Please consider protecting landmark trees. Thank you. Have a good meeting.
Thank you.
Honorable Mayor, Council, staff, friends, and friends at home, I'm Joey Ricano with the Ocean Outfall Group, but tonight I'm not here to talk about the ocean. Tonight I'm here to talk about those givers of oxygen, those sequesterers of carbon in these troubled times of global warming, these homes for the birds, the great shade that these trees provide. Today I'm talking about an imperiled species in Morro Bay, which is the heritage tree. The elders, the old ones, the ancient ones, the large ones, the ones who give shelter, the ones who create a haven for wildlife. I am vehemently opposed to this poor resolution. I don't know why the city of Morro Bay has chosen to declare war on trees. I am very happy that the appeal was upheld to stay the execution of the heritage trees near the Winter Bird Festival Center. That's what I call it. So what that they're not indigenous? I'm not indigenous. I'm Italian. If you want to remove indigenous things, start at Hearst Castle with the zebras. These trees are an important part of this community. They remain so. I urge you to pass a strong ordinance protecting trees. And I thank you for this opportunity to address you tonight.
Thank you.
Good evening. David Nelson. I haven't been here a while. I'm happy to be back here. I see you guys giving out all kinds of awards of gratitude to all kinds of people in our community. And I'm here tonight kind of to thank the hundreds and hundreds of people who supported CAPE, the Coastal Alliance on Plant Expansion. I'm a co-president of that, and I've been working with it for 8 years. I know that the council is very familiar with our work, and our attorney is. And I'm really happy to stand here tonight, and for all of our supporters who are out there that know that this battle is not over, many people believe that they're still going to build a power plant here. Well, we all know that that's not going to happen. But today, the Second Circuit Court denied a rehearing of the Phase 2 ordinances, so for us, it's a huge, huge victory. For some of you guys, I know you believe what the power companies told you, that their power plant's not hurting our estuary. Well, this really vindicates our argument, again, that it is hurting our estuary, and we all know it is, and it's time to put a stop to it. And hundreds of people in this community has backed this organization for many years because we know it's right, and we know it's going to happen. So to them, this is a victory for them as well as myself and many of you. So thanks to all those people. On that aside, I'd like to stand for the trees. I think any tree that was here before 1964 should be given citizenship and shouldn't be taken out of here, period, without a really good reason. I mean, some trees are diseased. The golf course trees were planted 35 years ago. They're all dead. Too bad they're gone. But the trees that have been here for so long, to let people cut them down. I'm interested in what we're going to do with our lot by the cloisters. What's the conditions on those trees? Are we going to sell those lots and let people just cut all those trees down? I mean, we saw that happen down here on Main Street, and just because, well, gee, we can't build houses. I mean, we got to make some judgments here. I mean, those trees are valuable, as all the other speakers have said. That's what makes us neat. That's what makes us unique. I know that some people believe that we're a coastal desert, and we are. But trees really do grow in deserts, and we've got some really nice ones, and I think they really should be protected. And I know that we have a business-leaning community right now, but that's not always going to be. You know, people are going to wake up and see that, you know, as you start changing our property around, it's going to hurt the town. So on that note, I'm speaking for the lot at Bonita and Main Street. To take that out of commercial use is just criminal, and you guys better think about that. We don't need housing as much as we need commercial property. I know you think it isn't going to work, but...
interested in keeping the quality of life that I see in Morro Bay and not having it deteriorate. And I'd like to address the concept of balance right now. As a property owner, I'm certainly for property owner rights. As a town member who lives now very close to neighbors, it's not like when I lived out in the country, I see how neighbors and the looks of their property affects the whole ambiance of the neighborhood. And I understand what was said earlier about the difference between an ordinance and a guideline or resolution. And I would like to see a strong ordinance protecting what I see as the ambiance and the beauty of Morro Bay. And on King Street, Kings Avenue, where I live, there are a lot of landmark trees, tall heritage trees on that street. Last night I went to sleep with the sound of the owls. That adds a lot. That was one of the reasons I bought on that street. So I would like to ask that there be some balance considered, that we have some sort of guideline initially, if we could get that passed tonight, and work towards an ordinance that a large tree that everybody sees and everybody hears the wildlife, that if it's 25 foot or taller, that tree, it's not just the property owner's decision, because everyone shares in the beauty. It goes beyond the little tiny lots that we have here in Morro Bay. And what I've learned in my lifetime so far, if we don't enact legislation to protect what we value, we surely will lose what we value. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Beverly Hardy. I've been a docent with the Museum of Natural History for 28 years, and I've seen our nesting trees disappear at an alarming rate. When they built Bayshore Village, they cut down the trees the cormorants nest in, and they moved into the rookery. The cormorants have a much more acidic droppings than the other birds there, so the trees in the rookery are dying out at an alarming rate. In addition, of course, with the dry year, the bark beetle is going to get into more of our pine trees and destroy those. The large nesting birds like the egrets, the herons, and the raptors and the owls need nesting areas, and our town is certainly losing them fast. We got prowling around for these trees in question where, and there's no doubt about the fact that the owls are nesting there. We found owl pellets, owls and turkey vultures. Of course, can't eat all the bones and the fur that they get in the feathers. So they throw up what they can't use And then the owl pellets, we found the skull of a mouse showing the value of these birds. So hopefully the man who knows it can cut down two trees this year and two or three next year.
Consider and work with the Audubon Society to have them help us designate which trees are nesting trees so that everybody gets a good idea of what we're talking about here. The nesting environment of the raptors, the egrets, the owls, and et cetera. And the five trees that we were talking about last week, I'm nervous. I had gone by them and the night before, and there were definitely owls in there. And I thought that owls' habitat was protected. So I would urge you to also consider that homeowners have special permission before they massacre these trees, because I agree with everything that everybody said so far. Trees are a thing of beauty, and Morro Bay has many, many aspects of beauty here. It isn't just our rock and our harbor and our beautiful ocean, but the trees add to that, and they add to the quality of life, and I would just hope that we would revere that, and thank you for letting me share.
Thank you.
Hello, members of the council and everyone else. I'm Nancy Dunn. I was coming tonight. Hopefully, I wanted to talk about a tree ordinance, but since it's not an ordinance, I thought I would take you on a little trip about how long it's been that I have wanted one. I've been here for 50 years, and in the late 50s and early 60s, a group of people in this community established a tree committee called Trees for Morro Bay. Some of the members are now deceased. I'm the ex-daughter-in-law of one of the prime movers in that. And so I come to you tonight to tell you that what we did at the time was we tried to present awareness of what was here, what was beautiful, what we placed as important to us as citizens of this community. We also did had enough publicity that the Telegram Tribune, the Sun Bulletin, KSBY television and radio news helped the community establish an awareness for our program and for one that they probably wanted as well. Because of this, Sunset Magazine somehow got on the line that we were here trying to protect the old grove trees, the blue gum eucalyptus, and everything else that is important in this community. And they sent a committee here, editors, research people, and a blue gum tree expert. And he came to talk to us about the 700 species of eucalyptus tree. And it's a very interesting story, too long for me to say to you, but they're planted all over but in many places of the world for reasons beyond beauty. I mean, I'm for the beauty, but they also have a wonderful aspect in leaves collecting moisture, which also gives water drop to the soil, et cetera, et cetera. So because of that, the expert said to us that one of the things that happens with tree removal is they're in the way. This is a kind of a crime. They're in the way. So we have lost a lot of trees in this community because, quote, they were in the way. So beyond that, we kind of died down for a decade or so, and then Jane and Don Bailey, who were instrumental in establishing the Morro Bay Life Saga, come to an end. So hoping that that will be the outcome, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good evening, City Council and Mayor. My name is Beverly Abbey, and I live in Morro Bay. I'd first like to just kind of take a little aside and tell you that prior to moving here 15 years ago, I frequently went between Ventura, where my family was, and up in Sonoma County, where I lived at that time. And I didn't know anybody in Morro Bay or in this area at all, but my daughter and I would often get off the road, and we first wanted to see the rock because I had never seen it. And as we started driving around, it frequently was around the estuary, and always when we've discovered Montaña de Oro, go out there, and it was just always so taken aback by it, really almost makes me choke up, the beauty of all the trees out there, and especially the eucalyptus. I guess I'm one of the ones that likes them, but the beauty of the whole area, I guess, is what I want to mainly emphasize.
and part of a large number of people that would like to express thanks to Roger Ewing for bringing forward the tree issues we want to discuss here tonight. I support C1 and C2 with potential amendments and felt compelled to come here tonight to speak. I would like for the citizens of Morro Bay to respond to this issue in a community sense, not nitpicking and tunnel visioned in a divisive manner, but seeing ourselves as a whole consciousness for our community to act as trustees of nature's beauty in the case of these landmark trees. I also just thought, too, we need to somehow reach the realtors and the developers and really make them, I guess, more aware of the issues you'd think they'd know, but perhaps that would help. But please consider carefully. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Bob Taft, citizen of Morro Bay. Thank you for bringing this resolution forward. It's a difficult issue, and I'm really glad to see it being brought to the fore. But be careful, okay? You're passing a resolution tonight, and you have given notice that there's an ordinance coming down the pike. If this resolution is not well-crafted, it will simply be a signal to turn on the chainsaws before the ordinance gets here. There are two really fatal flaws in this resolution. One is the very narrow findings that you have to arrive at in order to deny a coastal development permit for tree removal. You cannot, under the terms of this resolution, deny a permit because it would harm the environment, because it would harm the quality of life in Morro Bay, because it would detract from the scenic beauty of the city, or because it would do harm to the environment. Those are not allowed. Put those in. That's important. Okay. Why would you give up your power to review these things in a common sense, rational way? The second thing that is essential is that the two-tree exception for single-family residences should not apply to landmark trees. A beautiful 150-foot Norfolk pine is a community resource, okay, regardless of the fact that only one is being taken out. One may be one too many. So give Brazil, Chile, and Mexico, and 5% are hybrids that were invented in a warehouse someplace and don't even have a country of origin. There are, in the most generous possible interpretation, there are 8 native trees out of 58 on our city tree list. So let's don't talk about native trees. Let's put that one to bed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Mayor Peters and Council. My name is Michael Durek. I would like to express thanks to the Planning Commission for the courageous decision that they made last Monday night with a house full of rather anxious people, including myself. They did approve the appeal that Roger Ewing so thoughtfully filed regarding those landmark trees by the community center. So our hats should be off to the Planning Commission. And a message that I gave them, which I'm sure some of you saw on television, is it's their responsibility to get you guys off your butts to protect the trees. It's your job to do that. The people of Morro Bay want it done, and we're the ones that elect you, and we really do expect you to do it. Now, C1 and C2 are steps in the right direction, but as Bob just said, don't close the barn door after the horse is out. We've got a window of opportunity, negative opportunity, coming up after tonight, potentially, if you don't take the steps necessary, during which we could lose some substantial landmark trees. And I don't need to recite to you like I did the Planning Commission some of the trees that we have lost. You know where they are, or where they were, rather. When I moved here many years ago, I watched a neighbor cut down two perfectly healthy Monterey pines that had probably 4.5 to 5 foot diameter trunks. And I was absolutely astonished that they just disappeared and was told that, you know, that's perfectly acceptable behavior. So please, act correctly on C1 and C2, tighten them up. Give us an ordinance that protects trees on private property. Give us the ability to have landmark trees and enjoy the habitat. Enough said on trees. I want to say one item on D5. I'd like to echo Dorothy's comments and the other neighbors And I don't live near this development or this house, but I walk by there every morning. And last week, when I went by, and it was referred to as the sidewalk, you all know it's also the bike path on the ocean side of Main Street. There was a trailer, a large steak truck, two pickup trucks, all parked in the bike lane and the sidewalk. And when the owner of the property at 225 parks his vehicle in front of his garage, the garage apron is so inadequate that that truck takes up half the bike lane. Now, during this episode the other morning, I watched a lady with a baby in a stroller who had to go out into the Main Street traffic and go around all these vehicles. And you know how fast people go up and down Main Street. Very, very dangerous situation. And on many, many mornings, I can tell you, the bicyclists are now getting off of there, and they're riding in the street in the traffic because the bike lane is totally blocked. So you need to do something about that lease, and it shouldn't be approved. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Noah Smuckler, resident of Morro Bay. We have on our state water supply right now. And so we at Surfrider have really been promoting the improvements and protection of our current water supply and looking into the future with what we can do to bring more water to this area and enhance the water that's already here. So along those lines, we feel like the city has done a good job with the recent upgrade to the sewage treatment plant. Plan is going forward. We're excited about that. Feel like the investment in tertiary with the eye towards reclamation water recycling is exactly what we need to be doing here as a city to invest in our water supply. We also appreciate that the city is sending a representative to the upcoming pervious concrete workshop in San Luis Obispo. We think that there are a lot of opportunities here with our water, and that the technology, both new and old, is developing and being relearned and developed. So we can use the water on site here that is currently on site and coming down all around us in the form of rain and protecting our groundwater. A couple of quick things. We've been promoting the Bayside Living Guide that's been put together by the NEP because we feel like this is something that the city needs to work on as a whole, but each of us as residents of the city and individuals, we can make that choice individually that has a better impact on our water supply. So we encourage the looking through of the NEP guide, and we also promote strong protection of our trees, and we appreciate the city's work towards an urban forest management plan. We think that's of vital importance, and a strong tree ordinance protects those that pretty much purify our air, water, and soil. So we also appreciate that move and look forward to the new features presentation later on. Thank you.
Okay, with that in mind, there's five people left. I'm going to close off public comment after that because we need to get started with the rest of our agenda.
Good evening, Council. My name is Nancy Bast. I'm a resident. And last Monday night, that whole procedure would not have been necessary if the decision-making process to cut down our heritage trees was not left to the staff. Thankfully, Roger Ewing appealed it, so we did have a say-so, and it was changed. The important thing, the biggest issue here is to take that decision-making process out of the non-resident staff and give it back like we had prior to 1995, when the tree ordinance was rescinded, give it back to the people whose hearts and whose money are invested here, and let them determine what we want our community to be like. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. I'm Mary Jo DeCeo, and I, too, would like to speak on behalf of our beautiful Hallmark trees and our responsibility for ensuring that they're here for our children, for our posterity. And we think about the rights of private citizens, and I worry that that's a kind of a transient thing. People in our society don't stay in one place very long. They move around, and what one homeowner might do in a short period of time could have a strongly worded ordinance to protect this beauty that we have here. And that beauty really starts with our trees They are our environment. We have this gorgeous ocean, but what's an ocean without trees to look through? So thank you.
Thank you.
Ray McElligott, Morro Bay. I too want to talk about the eucalyptus trees that divides the property of the, from the school district to the 535 Dune Street. The applicant applied for a permit to cut down five large eucalyptus trees that borders his property. The staff okayed the project, but luckily it was appealed by Roger Ewing. And last week, the Planning Commission upheld Roger Ewing's appeal. These are Charles trees that appear to be healthy. If you allow them to be cut down, you will be setting a precedent that will allow more developers to cut down trees at will. The property lines should be determined before any consideration of trees are allowed to be cut down in that area. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, council people. I'm Lionel Johnston from Morro Bay. It really is a sort of a turning point in our history, I think, now, as newcomers to this land that we live on, where we're finally now really starting to see what we have and what works and what doesn't work, and adopting a sense of place. Americans are by nature rootless kind of wandering people, and now we've washed up here on the shores of the Pacific, and we can't wander anymore. So we have to stay here and really make this place our home, understand how it works, and protect it and beautify it. And right now, we've suffered a lot of loss from pine pitch canker and even the eucalyptus pests that are eating the red flowering eucalyptus. So we really need a sensible tree policy. And taking down big, healthy trees is probably the last thing we need to do right now at this time in our history. We don't really know what we're doing to the atmosphere of the planet, but we're probably changing it radically. And knowing what anybody knows about human nature, that's probably not good. But the tree issue, too, is that maybe in the future more appropriate trees will be planted. For instance, at the high school, we have a lot of island oak trees and canyon oak trees and redwood trees and sycamore trees and things like that. And those are the type of trees that really should be planted in the cityscape as well as in the yards. And that's something I will come to this meeting on Saturday and talk about. But the trees are available. I mean, we've been growing them. We got a nursery at Cal Poly, one at the growing grounds, and one at the high school. So, but as far as really protecting what we got, it would be a good idea because our business here really is as a tourist town. And how we look is really important. We have a brand. We have an identity, and it's this very natural place with these big green trees and lots of birds and stuff like that. And so to whack away at that, it's just like really, really not in bad business, to be quite frank with you. And so I think we would be really careful, have really good tree ordinances to protect trees, and I think we need to serve.
Hello. Gary Rain, Dune Street, 495. Before you guys get too carried away with all the trees, I know everybody wants to look at everybody else's tree. They never take into consideration the private property rights of the person who owns that tree. A lot of times people go to a nursery and they buy that 1 gallon tree and they plant it. And the next thing they know, 5 to 10 years went by, and now they've got a 20-foot tree in the wrong spot that's tearing up everything under the sun. And if what you people are saying right now, they could not cut down that tree because it's probably over 6 inches in diameter. I've planted 8 oak trees on our property in the last probably 8 to 10 years. Every one of them is over 6 inches in diameter. Now, if it turns out that one of them happens to be in the wrong spot, if I understand what you're talking about today, I couldn't cut down my own tree that I planted that's now maybe tearing the roof off because it grew in the wrong direction or something else. So you got to be careful what you wish for. They've never talked in here tonight about what is the reasonable life expectancy of a eucalyptus tree. The ones that they're talking about across the street, I've lived there off and on because it was my grandparents' place, and I come and go since 1942. There are some of those trees that are hollow because they're rotted out. Now, you tell them they can't cut it down and it falls down, somebody in the city is going to be liable. You got to look at more than just, is it a tall tree that a bird lives in? And when you make these ordinances, it's great. I love trees too. But you can't just say you can't cut down any tree on any property. It's unrealistic. Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Heineman, resident of Morro Bay, Mayor Peters, city staff. I'd like to make three or four points. First of all, Mike Durek was talking about how at the Planning Commission, we all held our breath when one of our city planners came forth and said that there was no biological life in those five blue gum trees, and therefore they were available to be cut. And I can only assume that he must have been asleep in his natural history class. Also at the Planning Commission meeting, they found that due to the narrowness of this proposed resolution, it's inconsistent with the general plan. In reference to the last speaker, I believe that trees that are planted by homeowners do not fall into an ordinance ruling. And also what I'd like to know from Mr. Schultz is what the status is of those five blue gum trees. Because as we know from our experience in Morro Bay and the post office and the pine tree, is that trees can disappear overnight. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all. Obviously, we're going to have some discussion about this later on. In response to a couple of things, well, I guess all of that's going to be discussed later. So any comments on comments? Okay. All right, we need to get back to work. Has anybody seen Betty? All right, we're on. Everyone, please, if I could have your attention. We are back in session right now. And we're looking at item B1, our first public hearing. This is the New Futures final report. If you're going to keep talking, could you please step outside? We're trying to do business here. All right, and Rob, I believe this is your report. Or at least you're introducing it. Hmm? Yes.
Yes.
unless you want Melody to. She was on the committee, so she certainly can.
I guess I'll start out with the staff report. Tonight's B1 is the New Futures final report. In October of 2005, my office presented to the City Council a staff report regarding the potential alternatives for the Morro Bay Power Plant property. The staff report concluded with the council voting 5-0 to form a new future. It was actually just called a power plant alternative site committee, and they came up with the names of naming it New Future, standing for North Embarcadero Waterfront Futures Committee. That committee met many times over the years. I was present only in a handful of them. From a staff standpoint, that's always great when it needs very little staff input. They worked excellent on their own, and I felt like when I was there, I even complicated things too much and spoke too much. So they did a great job in their hard work.
I congratulate the committee, and I welcome Michael Lucas to begin the presentation. I believe four members of the New Futures Group will give a PowerPoint presentation and then invite questions and comments.
All right, and then there will be a public hearing after that.
Madam Mayor and actual and virtual council, it's my pleasure and our pleasure to present this report to you tonight. This is the logo we came up with very early on, the idea that the power plant property is really the linchpin of Morro Bay to the ocean, the Embarcadero to the beach, and the city's path to multiple scenarios for its future. And so the history of the site's really very fascinating because it's a site that's made. Some sites are found. This one has been made. Here you can see in the prehistoric past, the beaches are far away from the western shore we have now. As much as 3,000 years ago, the sand spit is formed. The creeks are systems of lagoons, much like we see the slough today. And over time, people started to look at the west coast, where are we going to develop ports? So even in the 1800s, there were surveyors going through the area looking for this western port for the developing United States. This is actually from an 1880s survey where it still shows Morro Creek emptying behind the primary dune system into the north part of Morro Bay. You see the rock is isolated. You see the beginnings of the town grid established that the surveyor noted. By the 1930s, the federal government had looked at the WPA coming in and establishing the bulkhead and filling in behind the rock to take out the northeast channel that we know today. But even here in the 1930s, you can see the remnants of the lagoon. There had been a storm in the 19-teens that cut a channel through the primary dune, and Morro Creek went out to the ocean at that point. And here's some images of the 30s of the rock isolated and then with the WPA bulkhead. Of course, in the 1940s, the amphibious assault base, the government came in again and established the bulkhead that formed the Embarcadero that we enjoy today. And as much as 20 feet came in to that lagoon system to form the platform that the base used for operations. And of course, this is the beginning also of some possible contamination that we don't have documented. Here's a view of the amphibious assault base with the two T-piers. And then in the 1950s, of course, PG&E comes in and says that we'd like to purchase part of the property to develop power. This water-dependent kind of industrial use is established, and the single stack plant is constructed with the intake and outfall structures as well as the tank farm. Here's the single stack plant with the amazing new material aluminum used to sheath it. Just to remind us that these cycles, natural cycles, repeat themselves. A large storm in the 50s breached the sand spit again, and you see the one stack plant down there in the corner. And by the 1970s, the plant had added two more stacks, two more generators. The tank farm had expanded. You start to see the city grid filling in structures along the Embarcadero. And then, of course, the
industrial. Any use aside from industrial would require rezoning. There are stringent deed restrictions on the property that would need to be renegotiated with PG&E before anything other than a fossil-fueled power plant or a substantially other use could occur on the property. any scenario would require the remediation of contaminants on site. Contaminated sites are classified as brownfields. PG&E is responsible for remediation of the site to industrial standards. Remediation beyond industrial standards is required for uses other than industrial, such as assembly, business, or education. Further remediation would be the responsibility of a redevelopment group. Three basic scenarios: no change, plant modernization, plant closure. No change. The plant continues to operate as a peaker plant under contract with PG&E or another utility company. Redevelopment of the tank farm may be possible. Plant modernization project. To our knowledge, Dynergy, the current plant owners, are pursuing the modernization project. Plant closure. Under this scenario, the entire site, with the exception of environmentally sensitive areas, would be redeveloped, or could be redeveloped. These sensitive areas encompass the majority of the site: Morrow Creek, Willow Camp Creek, Dune Habitat, and the Monarch Butterfly Habitat. PG&E also owns approximately 26 acres adjacent to Highway 1, used as a switchyard. This switchyard is integral to a larger power grid reaching out to Napomo, Diablo, and the Central Valley. Conversations with PG&E brought up the possibility of relocating the switchyard if it became feasible. The community desires. Our committee began gathering input on the community desires for the property by looking at the public comments from the October 2005 City Council meeting regarding Duke Energy's proposal to sell the Morro Bay Power Plant. These are summarized in Appendix A. Members of our committee made presentations to all the advisory boards and members of the business community. We also organized a public workshop in September 2006. The raw data from that workshop is located in Appendix B. Did we miss one? Anyway, quite a spectrum of suggestions were received. From all of this input, we determined that any redevelopment should meet the following criteria: be marine orientated, be environmentally responsible, reflect values of the Central Coast, provide economic benefits to the city, include cultural, educational, and artistic components. Readaptive reuse. The community saw adaptive reuse as an opportunity of great value because the existing power plant structure could house almost all the proposed uses from the community's desires. We would have the city consider adaptive reuse of the structure under scenarios 2 and 3. Rachel will talk briefly about how common
cultural significance. I'm going to just breeze through the case studies that appear in Appendix C. This is the Gasworks Park in Seattle, and what you see here is an industrial ruin in the middle of a landscaped park. This is the power plant in Baltimore, and it's similar to our power plant here where it's at a pivotal location in the city. They've created a mixed-use development here, and you can actually see possibly in this interior shot one of the stacks actually penetrates through the building. This is the Powerhouse Museum of Science and Technology in Sydney, and here you see in the bottom right-hand corner the old construction next to the new construction. That also occurs here in the Harborfront Center, where there's a glass curtain wall system that goes around the masonry building. This is the Tate Modern Museum in London across from St. Paul's Cathedral. This is also an very dense urban setting, and this is the Tate at night. Here we see an interior shot where a central skylight has been placed for natural daylight. This is the Battersea Power Plant, also along the Thames, when it was operating during the war era. This is the plant in its current condition. They've actually gutted the interior, and this is a proposal by AREP to actually redevelop the plant. They would still use one of the stacks for power generation. That facility is located in the lower left. And they have green roofs, a glass skylight there, and public park and plaza areas. This is the Seaholm Power Plant in a very industrial setting where they've come up with a redevelopment proposal. This was the same firm that did the proposal for the Baltimore Power Plant, which was the mixed use. This is a much smaller scale adaptive reuse where it was converted into loft and apartment spaces. So what we want to see here is a sustainable approach to redevelopment of our power plant. We have a legislative environment with AB 32 that requires greenhouse gas emissions being reduced. We have AB 1078 that requires us to start investing in renewable energy, providing 20% by 2010 and one-third by 2020. We have programs such as the Department of Energy's Brownfields to Brightfields program, which takes an innovative look at a contaminated site and says, okay, let's not take out all the contaminants, let's just cap it and put a solar array across it so they actually produce energy and create an educational plaza. This is Ken Haggard's vision of a sustainable Morro Bay here. He's tried to incorporate as many sustainability concepts as possible. Starting from the left, he has a cultural center for the indigenous folks of the area. He's expanded the Marine Mammal Center, put vertical access wind turbines atop the stacks, done an adaptive reuse scheme of the power plant structure, put a bright field on the tank farm with pedestrian and bicycle paths. He's done some creek restoration along with a waste-to-resource facility at the wastewater treatment plant, similar to what you find in Arcata and Petaluma. And because of the proximity to the high school and everyone not wanting to maintain the creek areas, you could actually have a creek preservation program with the high school students where they actually maintain the creek. So there are opportunities out there that wouldn't involve burdening the citizens here, and there are grants such as the Sustainable Communities Grant and Loan Program, which would give up to $500,000 for planning costs. $350,000 would be a grant and $150,000 a 0% loan for 5 years. We also have local resources such as Slow Green Build that could give advice.
Mark, creating a sense of place for the city. And the power plant has such impact because of its monumental size and waterfront location. And due to that size, there's a ton of embodied energy that went into creating such a large machine. Excavation was around 838,000 cubic yards, approximately 16% the volume of Morro Rock. And the concrete that was used is approximately 7,000 very full concrete mixer trucks. The footprint of the building is 125,000 square feet, so over several layers it creates a lot of space. And the stacks are 450 feet tall. The structural steel is over 10,000 tons. That's approximately 7,900 Honda Civics. The reinforcing steel at over 8,000 tons. And the single heaviest piece of equipment is the generator stator weighing 224 tons. Quite a bit of architectural detailing went into the building. Including the corrugated aluminum cladding. This material was used because of its resistance to corrosion and rust in the humid and salty air. And the powerhouse structure reaches 152 feet tall at its highest point. So a person is very small in comparison with that elevation there. More important than the size and the energy already input into the building, I feel that there's a certain regional identity that exists within the city of Morro Bay. The adaptive reuse of the power plant would create an opportunity to preserve parts of Morro Bay's past, also while enhancing the culture and region for the future of the city. Here is a general massing of what the building may consist of. The organization was based on volumes within the existing structure and circulation, location and orientation, the views, adjacencies to other functions, and approximate areas. The program components were derived from the community workshop held in September. As seen in San Luis Obispo, the recent idea of airspace subdivisions could be effective in this application, where within a single building there could be several owners or leases for specific spaces. Here's a breakdown of the areas within the project. The program organization was intended to create a diverse mixture of functions, which when grouped together would create a strong basis for sustained development. It could become a complex which could hold various functions, including renewable energy research, auditorium, even civic offices, which could hold such events like tonight, museum, adaptable convention space, possible enclosed butterfly palace, amenities, restaurants, educational facilities for environmental education, housing, hotel, or offices, commercial and visitor serving, which would be adjacent to a public level at the level 41 in the elevation of the building, and up to 300 parking spaces depending on the amount of renovation on the structure. There it is. Sorry about that. A bit dark. We're bright in here. Here's an idea image of the redevelopment to become an adaptable convention space where the cranes could actually hoist products and interior display structures, or something like a butterfly sanctuary with an industrial feel. This is the turbine hall from the opposite angle. The left is to the left is Renewable Energy Research Center with a Unit 2 generator, which could be sectioned so that the visitors could see the inner workings of a generator, and also the existing control rooms, which could become displays and energy education. Here's a view of the proposed occupancy unit. As you can see, there's quite a good view of the rock and the strand, which could potentially become a hotel or inclusionary housing, even secondary homes. If there is no need for housing, the upper prefabricated units could become offices. And lastly, is a night rendering of the developed power plant, which you can also see in the report. I believe it has a unique impact on the waterfront, and light would be directed down and away from the city and its surrounding neighborhoods. So for more information, you could check the appendix of the report. And now I'd like to reintroduce Michael Lucas.
I think in conclusion, what we noted in our research is that there's tremendous opportunities for economic development, incorporating sustainability, social equity, and acknowledging our ecosystems and their preservation within the workings that are possible. And the good thing is these aren't isolated from good development. They're incorporated in a lot of good development that's been done. Our main recommendation is that the timing on this is becoming very interesting. There are certain deadlines coming up that the owners will have to take a look at, and our recommendation is that you sort of up the importance of the committee by maybe forming a liaison group that would include members from the council, some senior staff, and perhaps members of the New Futures group. The opportunities are just immense. I think we all enjoyed trying to look at how this can benefit the city as well as take into account some of these fascinating features that are special to the facility and to the city itself. And we welcome any questions that you might have.
Okay, thank you. It's really an impressive report. Any questions before we have our public hearing?
Just one for Ross. Is that model in the back actually representative of your senior project that you presented?
Yeah.
Okay.
You need to be at the microphone. It's worth talking about. It's beautiful.
It's mainly a representation of the existing structure, just to show the possibilities of what could be.
And, Ross, is it also true that you got a lot of assistance from the current owners of the power plant to get this much information about the square footage and such?
Yes. I was working closely with Steve Goschke, who is the plant manager.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Mayor, it's too bad we can't move that model up to one of the front tables so the cameras can get a look at it.
Is it movable or not?
Helped with us. And financiers, bankers, business owners. I'd particularly like to thank Michael Lucas as he walks away from that model for an awful lot of research he did, in addition to all the work he does for the city on the Planning Commission. I'd particularly like to thank Rachel Al-Jelani for her incredible design of the report, which has been complimented. I'd like to acknowledge Homer Alexander as a guy who has been there from the very beginning, before we even appointed this group. He was in the Little Citizens Volunteer Group. Bill Robinson back there, was just took over chairing this committee, swore he was only going to do it 3 weeks, and he stayed on for the duration up to this moment. One of the other recommendations that Michael didn't cover is as to what happens to the new Futures Committee. And we would like to remain intact but kind of inert at this point because we feel that we've done everything possible. They have really contributed every possible thing, including Rachel attending a Brownfields conference. And I think that at this point it's really more up to the city what we do.
Okay. This is a public hearing, so if you would like to
look at a picture in a minute.
Yeah, if you would like to speak on this issue, please come forward.
Hi, Joey Ricano, Ocean Outfall Group. Of course, it's a phenomenal day when this has all come together, and Councilwoman DeMeritt, you deserve all the credit in the world. It's pretty incredible the way Rachel came up and did not use any notes. She did that whole thing on the fly. It was amazing because it was lengthy and good. And I just think that this is a great day for possibilities for Morro Bay and the way that they work together with the power plant to do this. And I can't wait to get a nice shot of this incredible model that was made. It's really staggering in its scope. If you look at it, the detail is amazing. So thank you very much.
Okay.
Good evening, David Nelson, Citizen of Morro Bay. I'd like to thank you too, Melody. I know that you put so much work in on this, along with your people. I was privileged to be at a few of your meetings, and just incredible people. We are so blessed in this town with so much talent. If only we could become one and actually focus our energies and make these things come true. Well, these things are getting closer to being true because we're talking, because we're discussing things. This is what we need, and this is a fine, fine representation for a bunch of volunteers. It's a heck of a lot of work, and, you know, I have nothing but admiration for the people because they had an impossible job. You ask them to go out to redevelop a property that we don't even own. It may not even be available, but these people went ahead and they had vision. And they see things, and they're showing them to us, and I hope that we have what it takes to do it, because the only thing stopping us is us, because it's being done everywhere on Earth. This is a albatross, and it should be put in a museum. And
good evening. Noah Smuckler, Chair of the San Luis Bay Chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. And we would also echo CAPE's concern for the state of our estuary and the impact the power plant currently has on the health of our estuary and community overall, both the intake and the outfall parts of the plants. And when we look at the overall situation we have here on our planet, with the reports of different fluctuations and storms and these extremes all across the globe, and then also look at the image of our power plants and the emissions there and the outfall there and the intake there, and take those images and turn it into something exciting and inspiring, that's really an amazing thing. And we would really like to extend our gratitude and thanks to the New Futures Committee and the work that's been done among staff and everyone here. To this is really the visions that we need as a society on this planet to go into the future. And we really appreciate these leaders and people that are taking time out of their busy lifestyles to pitch in and show what they can do and have to offer. And so we really appreciate the entire New Futures Committee, and we strongly encourage the council to adapt a liaison committee, I think it was called, yes, and proceed, because we think this is a positive vision that we have here, and it only promotes the long-term well-being of our community. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm Ken Haggard again. As I earlier tried to start on, is sort of looking at the historical pattern.
Please introduce yourself again, though.
Yeah, Ken Haggard from Santa Margarita, okay. And I'm one of the committee members. But so it's a historical pattern here. This is sort of the summary thing from my viewpoint. 50s, the early 60s was an era of real large technological progress in the United States. It had a lot of negative spinoffs, too, but generally resulted in rapid changes, increased standard of living, and social mobility. And I think the power plant is architecturally and historically and symbolically expressive of this era. Now we're 50 years later. That's what I was trying to get to earlier about having gray hair. We've entered another era of progress, and this one is new technologies again, some very tough challenges we have before us, global warming and peak oil and all that things. But there's also new opportunities. And so we're entering this another era of progress, and it's different in many ways from the previous one, and yet it's connected. And it's easy to see the differences if we compare the patterns between what the committee has shown you is possible here and what the plant originally was, I think clarifies some of this. So I'd like to go through that real quickly if I could, which you know, you're way back there, but you may not see. But here we have the old pattern, which the plant is a kind of stellar example of. Single-purpose, highly specialized facility based on linear flows of fuel, electricity, and money, dependent upon a coolant source, the ocean, and a atmospheric dump for some of the pollutants, to create an efficiency of scale for power production. At that time, that was real progress. Of 2007, center of a built-out town with an underutilized power plant on the site on the most popular coast of the most popular state in the union. So as 50 years ago, this new pattern in new context offers great opportunities for the city, the plant owners, and the public. And I think the details of these opportunities are what is presented to you by the committee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Mayor, Honorable Council, Bill Woodson, resident. It would be wonderful to achieve this, and I sincerely hope it ultimately happens. But I'm an old power plant engineer, and I'm trying to see how we can get there. Let's take the switchyard alone. The switchyard is owned by PG&E and will remain PG&E property. It can be relocated, but the switchyard is an electrical node providing flexibility and stability to the regional grid. So you need to have one there in the area. So relocation of the switchyard is not impossible, but it entails a substantial property footprint. It would involve realignment of the transmission lines and the rights of way, which are all incredibly expensive. I know you're going to start at $100 billion and go up from there. 5 years ago, Duke estimated the removal of the existing plant to be $38 million. So probably at 5%, you can double that in 10 years. So that did not include removing or changing the switchyard. So you have to add that to removing or changing the switchyard. I believe the only viable, realistic approach is to have a new power plant with proviso that, with an airtight MOU with the city, that at its the new power plant's useful life, that it provide the property a cleared site, and that should be in the MOU. This will provide the resources to be able to achieve the things that we just saw tonight, which are ultimately in the best interests of this city, and it will provide an appropriate legacy to our next generation.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to the council. All right, the recommendation here is to form a liaison committee to look at the future of the site with the owners of the power plant, and comprise it of two council members, two new future members, and two city management level employees. So if we could kind of focus our discussion around that suggestion. Melody, you want to start?
Before I start, I feel very bad that I didn't acknowledge a couple of other people, and one being Ken Haggard, who got up and talked. He's been instrumental in the content and the work and the arguments and everything pushing this ahead. And then the far back, being very humble, there is Kathy Novak, representing the power plant, Morro Bay Power Plant. And she attended every single meeting, kept us honest, and kept reminding us of who owns that property right now. So that was the first thing. Secondly, I'd like the property and do something with it should the owners decide that they'd like to do something differently. I have to come back and talk about that money question on the copies. But as to the recommendations, I think that I handed out this copy to everybody of this article about City Council prepares to battle power plant. This is not the first City Council we've heard of in the San Diego area. The Chula Vista City Council decided to slow down a power plant. I think it was a rebuild down there. Rob would know, but this is one that's not even built yet. And I think that a lot of city councils are getting the notion that we need to be major players in these discussions. And I know that Mayor Peters and Councilmember Pierce were instrumental in the lease discussions. I mean, you spent all this time working through to that outfall lease. I think we still need to be engaged with these people. I mean, because things are changing. I didn't even know about the Second District Court's ruling today on the Riverkeepers. I just hear that information. I just think that we need to get in there. And when we talked as a committee, we were certain that we don't mean any offense to anyone, but we don't mean to talk to public relations people or liaison types of people. We mean to sit down with a representative from the heart of the ownership, and fairly high level. That's why we suggested bringing in some management staff from the city to sit down and just put all of our cards on the table, get them a copy of this, and say, we've actually done the owner of the power plant property a great favor. If they were ever thinking that it was going to get too hard or too obnoxious to continue once through cooling, we've given them the document that they walk around with to developers, but we need to tell them that. And that's what our committee would do. And then as to the new futures committee, the second of the main recommendations, there's several things here. The list 1 through 10, I believe, was just ideas, you know, things, ways you could continue. But the second one is that the new futures committee actually really likes each other, and we get along very well. And rather than disband us or make us nonprofit or anything, we would suggest that the city council leave us alone to be basically kind of quiet while this liaison committee is doing some work. So that, because there's really not much more that the committee can do, but to disband them and to reform with brand new people, when these people are absolutely knowledgeable, as this thing makes progress over the coming years and we see, are we going to get a new power plant built? And even if the new power plant's built, we'd like to talk to them about, could we reuse your old power plant? I would just suggest that we keep them intact and kind of left alone for a little well-deserved vacation at this point. So I hope that clarifies the recommendations in the report. I don't know that we need to form a liaison committee tonight, but I would certainly urge that we do that soon. In fact, very soon.
Okay. Bill?
Well, first, let me say that I'm looking at this in some form or another, and I could certainly see us having some conversations more seriously with the power company, saying, well, okay, if it doesn't work out, what are you going to do with it? The last thing in the world we want to do is have you lock it up and drive away, which is probably a very likely scenario if they decide to close it. And I think that's the one thing we want to prevent, so I think we should continue working to make sure that doesn't happen, regardless of what we do end up by doing with it. That's not the thing that should happen.
Betty?
Well, I would echo Mr. Pierce's comments and Ms. Merritt's. Just a tremendous number of kudos to each of you for your dedication, your time, selfishlessness, in bringing this forward. It's been a year and a half, And the whole community will benefit from the work that you've done, and thank you for doing that. I, again, support Mr. Pierce also in agreeing that we need to continue dialogue with and would accept recommendation number two to try to dialogue with the power company, and accept recommendation number one that we allow the committee to take a hiatus but not to disband. We may want to call them back.
Okay, well, I want to add my praise, too, and just to encourage people, this is the report we're talking about. It's amazing. The illustrations of the possibilities of what we could do with this property are absolutely fantastic and inspiring and gorgeous, and you just kind of wish you could wiggle your nose and have it happen. But so I do encourage all of you to take a trip down to the library, or where else is it, at Mills and City
it's
Hall,
at Mills
and
City
take
Hall.
A look at it if you can, because it really is fascinating. A lot of information here, a lot of really valuable information about what's been done in other places and the possibilities for here. Rob, question on an ad hoc committee like this, is this something that they can just stay in existence and meet once a year or something until we need them again?
Yes, until action by the council to disband the ad hoc committee, they'll stay in existence. And I would suggest maybe, you know, a year or 2 years, we look at it each year when we're looking at all the mm-hmm. other committees just to see how they're doing and if there's enough members, if some have dropped off. So maybe in January we'll schedule it when you're doing all your other committee members just to make sure you've got the requisite amount of, that you do have on it.
Okay. So we don't even need to make a motion on that. We can just let it stay. On a liaison committee, is that something that we can go ahead and pull out of that and do that tonight?
You could do it now and decide who those people would be, or you could wait till you have a full council and we can reschedule it for a different meeting. It's up to you.
Okay. Well, then what would be your pleasure? You want to wait until Rick's back, or what would you like to do?
I would suggest that we agendize it for one of the two August meetings and have Rick back, because it'll be two of us and two other people. And that would allow some time for me to talk with the New Futures members. We traffic a lot in Internet and see who would be willing or would desire, actually, with this committee, would desire to continue.
Okay.
We'll have a hard time drawing short straws. But I like that idea, and I also appreciate, Rob, that we can stay intact.
There was something else in here about becoming a nonprofit. Is that something that we need to look at now, or
center, or City Hall?
This one's so fragile, I'd worry about it. But I don't know that.
Well, certainly, I think the ones on the wall would be worthwhile in the lobby of the library, perhaps for a time. And I can talk with them about who owns what and how we can get that installed.
Yeah. All right.
I do have one other
yes
issue to talk about, and and that is back in Appendix N of the report, you can see the money spent by the committee, and it shows that we spent a total of the $2,500 designated for this work. We spent a total of $1,800 up until we took this to get printed at Mills. And so Rachel and I very diligently went first to the city clerk, and she told us that we needed to get 10 copies for all of us, for the two staff and the three over at the library. So then we went next to the finance director's office, and we were told that we had no more money. And I said, well, what happened to the $1,200 or so dollars left? And she said that it is our standard thing that when you don't use your money by the end of the fiscal year, that they roll it back into the general fund. I was horrified to hear that. I held my breath. I said, I'll pay for it with my discretionary money. And today I heard that these copies, because of the complexity of the documents and all the inset things, cost $600. I'm still willing to spend my discretionary money on those copies. I went to Mills today and found out that other people in town are going in and paying the money, and they want copies of this report. They've heard about it and are getting copies. I would like to explore, is that what happens with money that's assigned to a particular purpose? Does it just roll back into the general fund? And does that always happen with everything? And I would also like to explore getting it back. somehow out of the general fund so it could pay for these copies, even if it was just for the Mills bill. And I think one receipt, a small receipt from Ms. Algelani.
Yeah, I wondered about that, too, because we do have some special funds and things. And I know our discretionary funds roll back in, but I thought if it was designated for a specific purpose that it stayed in a fund. And I'm a little worried, like the dog park fund, is that intact?
That would be probably, I guess I have to be the financial director. that would be a 9/11 account, the dog fund, so that's set up. Chances are, and I found this out when my first year coming in as a city employee, when we designated money for the Cloisters litigation, the $25,000, that went into just my operating legal counsel account, and at the end of the year it was gone even though I hadn't used it. And so I had to come back and get a reallocation from you halfway through when I was told I had no money. So probably that $2,500 must have been put in your operational budget of the city administration office.
I think it was in city administration.
And then
right.
At the end of the year it goes back. All of our operating budgets go back that we don't use.
But my suggestion would be that you simply pay the costs out of the council operating budget at this point.
Okay.
The printing costs.
The $600.
That way. Yeah.
Okay, because actually that's about exactly what was left, about 700 and something, and so it would.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I think that's a good way to do
it. So, Bob, can you handle that with Susan then tomorrow?
Administrative citation program, Rob.
Thank you.
That's to New Futures Group.
Yes, good evening again. This item in front of you is to add Chapter 1.03 of Section 1 of the Morro Bay Municipal Code pertaining to administrative citation program. It's the first hearing and public hearing, first reading and public hearing. Many cities throughout California, including Morro Bay, it's become increasingly frustrating.
Excuse me a second. I'm sorry. We need to be able to hear up here. If you could take the conversations outside, please.
They are outside.
No, they were.
It's become increasingly frustrating using the criminal proceedings to process code enforcement violations, and I can bring up just examples in the last 6 months when we get to those. But it's really provided inadequate for us, especially now, although we do still have code enforcement, we no longer have a code enforcement officer per se in our employee force. And so it's a combination of myself and the planning, building, and police carrying those functions, so it's become increasingly difficult. In 1995, the government code was amended to allow an administrative process where a city can cite municipal code violations under an administrative citation process instead of doing it as we currently do, which requires a criminal citation, which requires you to go down to court or either pay your fine or plead not guilty and pay your fine and have a trial proceeding. This takes a tremendous amount of employee time. If they plead not guilty and the court has continuances, my last one a couple of weeks ago was for a violation regarding too many chickens on a property. The notice said 1:00. Both myself and the defendant were there. The defendant had pleaded not guilty. The court says, oh, we made a mistake. It's at 3:00. So now you have 2 hours to wait around until you get your hearing, and then the judge is always on his time, not yours. So it can be increasingly frustrating. On top of that, for a $100 fine, the city sees between $10 and $15 of that $100. The rest goes to the county for their administrative costs. So they have amended it, and every single city within these Central Coast has already gone to the administrative citation program. Paso just did it recently, and so I'm now asking that we do this for our city. It'll save a tremendous amount of money. It is a work in progress. I have not worked with the city since I came to the city in 97, and this was formulated in 95. It is somewhat of a work in progress. I looked at many, many different ordinances and went to two conferences and tried to come up with the most simplified administrative code citation program at this time possible. And then, like I said, as a work in progress, it might come back with changes over the next couple of years as we see how it's implemented. I've tried to give the maximum time.
basically weigh the only procedure differently, and we do not have that many citations of the municipal code. We currently cite parking citations that come directly to the city, and you'll have a hearing in front of a hearing officer, a non-biased, non-employee hearing officer. Those will probably be held on a quarterly basis, maybe only twice a year, because I don't see us issuing that many citations. We usually get voluntary compliance for any of our municipal code violations. Another area that just popped into my mind is liverboards. We somehow have problems with liverboards that aren't allowed in certain areas on our harbor, and this will give the harbor officers a tool to either warn them, and if they do not and continue to live on a liverboard that's not allowed, then they could be cited. And so you'd have the hearing process in front of the hearing officer, who would then rule one way or the other, and then that could still be appealed to the court system. So they still have their due process rights with the court system. It's just that hopefully it will be resolved within the city, and the fines then also go completely to the city. So that's pretty much in a nutshell. Again, I've tried to make it as simple as possible. Based on your previous suggestions, I added the warning of administrative citations, and I did lengthen a little bit on the service and notices, exactly what has to be done properly to proper service and notices, which were a couple of changes from your previous draft to this draft. And with that, I'll answer any questions, then you can open up to public comment and hopefully do first reading and adoption.
Okay. Any questions, Betty?
I have two questions. First, though, just on page 2 of 6, Rob. You got that one? Okay. Then further up the page under letter A, paid to the administrative hearing officer. Is this something yet to be worked out, the pay that this person will receive, or how this person, is this will be completely at the discretion of the city manager?
I am hoping we'll have no pay. I am working. Most cities have been able to get voluntary retired, either police officer, usually somebody in law enforcement or has a law background, to do it a couple of times a year for their 8 hours. And if you can schedule on that day, all the other cities have found someone on a volunteer basis.
Because I remember that from the previous document, and this one made it sound like, no, it will be, the person will be paid.
I've left it in there that if we have to, then
so
we have
the option.
To pay.
It's optional. Yes. Okay. So, and then on page 4, administrative citation hearing letter C, to whom should a person request the hearing form? Do we need to put in there it's from City Hall? Is it from Planning Commission? Is it from the Police Department? To whom should a person seek that?
Administratively, we haven't decided. We think it's going to be handled by the Police Department, and that's where the forms would be, because that's currently where you do it for your parking citations. But I haven't specifically stated. But, I mean, wherever they go to pay it, it'll be on the ticket.
It'll be on the ticket itself,
right.
So they'll know.
So
great.
We haven't really done the ticket form yet. Okay. That's our next step once we see that this is going to be passed, to show this is where you pay, this is where you get the form. It'll even have exactly what needs to be done on the back of every ticket. So you don't have to go to the ordinance. It'll tell you all
right
your
here.
Steps to do
great.
Right on the ticket.
That's great. I very much appreciate the work on this.
Any questions, Bill? Melody? No? Okay. Shall we have?
And the alleged violator insists on their day in court. Setting aside for the moment what the program would create a new city bureaucracy that would create additional costs, what price will citizens pay if this is adopted? If a citation is issued, the citizen cannot avail themselves of any kind of a hearing unless they first pay the fine for the alleged offense. Whatever happened to innocent until proven guilty? We call this quaint concept presumption of innocence. At the hearing officer shall only consider, quote, evidence that is relevant, end quote. This is most curious in light of the fact that later in the proposed ordinance, it states that the rules of evidence shall not apply. Rules of evidence are designed to make sure that only relevant information is considered and that citizens are not unfairly prejudiced by allegations at trial. So much for the rules of evidence. While citizens may be given the opportunity to testify, they are not given the opportunity to cross-examine the witness against them. because the officer who wrote the citation will not even be at the hearing. The citing officer supports their citation by making a written report to the hearing officer after the citation is issued and before the hearing. So much for the accused being allowed to confront witnesses against them. And to push the scales of justice down even further against the citizen, the paperwork submitted by the citing officer, quote, shall constitute prima facie evidence of the facts they allege. In case you don't know what prima facie means, it's Latin for guilty until proven innocent, or more simply stated, it means you'll lose. Now let's say the citizen wants to get more information about the facts underlying their situation. They can't. That's because the ordinance also provides that no other discovery is permitted for the citizen. So much for that part of due process. But even though the citizen has no right of discovery, the hearing officer does. And they can consider it after the hearing is over and before they make their decision. In some places, this might be considered double jeopardy. The hearing officer gets to ask the citing officer for additional information and make the case after the hearing is held. Is this trial in absentia? Oh, yes. And the alleged violator be judged by a jury of their peers? Nope. It's a hearing officer appointed and removed at any time in the sole discretion of the city manager. So much for a trial by jury of one's peers. Well, there it is. I could say more, but it's up to you. What weighs heaviest on your scale of justice? A fistful of dollars or due process of law?
Okay, thank you.
Evening. My name is Stuart McElhinney, and I would like to speak of this matter, too. One of the things that concerns me about this and is the way in which the city, it's the complaint-driven nature of the process. This city is, in many places around here, code violations are normally instigated by somebody who complains about a code violation. If it's going to be complaint-driven, then it should be completely out in the county than it is here, but it does occur here. I think that the complaint-driven nature of the process is really difficult to manage. It's a difficult question, but I think the council needs to address it because you're talking about putting in an expedited proceeding that essentially is unfair to the person who's being charged because it's loaded in favor of the complainant. It's loaded in favor of the code enforcement officer, and it's loaded against the person who is unfamiliar with dealing with things like this by themselves. There's no opportunity for sitting down with the people that are responsible and saying, let's do it. The preface of all this says that the city's preference is its voluntary cooperation, but there's nothing in the ordinance that says that. There's nothing in the ordinance that says we want to have this solve the problems before we get into the enforcement process. It's a difficult thing to write, but if you're going to make that your policy, you should make it your policy. The other thing is, probably the most glaring thing in my mind in this is that there's no opportunity for the person who is charged to complain about or challenge the hearing officer. The suggestion that we would use retired police officers as hearing officers, there is a predictable tendency by police officers to take police officers' word at face value. There's a predictable tendency for police officers to take the law enforcement side, and since this is an enforcement-driven process, it becomes even more unfair. That's the main thing. With regard to the evidence, the hearing officer can ask for more evidence, but the person who's charged has no opportunity to see that evidence or rebut it. And that's certainly something that should be in there. If the hearing officer wants more information, then the person against whom the information is offered certainly should have a chance to look at it and rebut it.
Okay. Thank you.
Good Good evening. My name is John Lemons. I'm a resident of Morro Bay. I'm primarily interested in another part of this. I'd invite you to look at page 7 of the report at the last section, section 4. This paragraph deals with the potential for any terms or provisions of this ordinance being in conflict with terms or conditions of any prior city ordinance, motion, resolution, rule, or regulation. If such conflicts exist, all conflicting provisions of the prior ordinances, motions, resolutions, rules, or regulations are hereby repealed. I suspect that there's no member of the City Council or any member of the audience, maybe no one in town, who can tell us how many ordinances we have on our books, nor can they say with any certainty how many conflicts might exist or what those conflicts might be.
Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to council. Rob, can you respond to the first Mr. Lemons comment about the inconsistency?
With Mr. Lemons, if you want to just take the word repealed and put in superseded, doesn't matter. All we're saying is that this supersedes anything that's been done, and this will be the document that will refer to administrative citations, and it's above everything else that has been passed in the past dealing with administrative citations. We don't have any, so I'm not concerned about it. You could take it out completely. It's a standard language that's in most ordinances you pass. So, I mean, I'm not concerned with that comment. About the process of this ordinance, it is no difference than the process that appears in court. You do not have, for any of the citations we're going to be issuing for infractions, you do not have the ability to ask for a jury trial. It's no difference. The bias of a police officer, I certainly do understand, and that perception, that same perception is there with a judge, with law enforcement also. And I'm certainly open to the idea of maybe we do have the ability for someone who's been cited to have the ability to put in that person's bias and ask for a different judge. If that's a process, we could come back with that and look at that. If you call that recusing the judge, where someone does have the ability to recuse a judge because they feel that they're biased and they get a different judge. We'd have to wait around for 6 months for the hearing to actually occur if we only do this twice a year. But I'm open to that idea. But it's really the same process. It's the same prima facie. If a law enforcement officer comes in and says, the person was speeding, I clocked him at 65, and you come in and say, I was only doing 55, the benefit goes to the police officer. They're going to believe him, and that's the same with the code enforcement officer. The prima facie is no difference. The substantial burden is still on the defendant to prove otherwise. It's not going to be any different. I don't see any difference in that proceeding. In fact, to my feeling, at least for the layperson, hates to go down to a court. It's very long. You'll wait down there all day on your date to plead not guilty. This gives you the ability to get a very quick hearing date, or at least know when that hearing date is. It you'll set it at 10 a.m. and it'll be that day at 10 a.m. It'll be within the city of Morro Bay instead of spending time going down, so you have more of an opportunity to have your day in court than you will through our judicial system. That's at least my feeling on it.
Okay, questions? Betty?
Responding to some of the concerns raised by the residents, I don't have an issue with the last section because there aren't, when you look at the municipal code, each section says what you can do, and this is trying to address all those in one fell swoop. So I'm fine with that word at the end in the last section.
You mean repealed or superseded?
Either one. It doesn't matter to me. I went to a hearing at the animal regulation building a few weeks ago, and I think this would be very typical of that. They have their officer who runs the meeting. There were two sides to it. Everyone gets to talk. He has his standard form. May not be a chance for negotiating with neighbors, but this issue before animal regulation was between a business and neighbors, and there had been numerous attempts by the parties to try to negotiate with each other, because they, I think people automatically do that. You know, if I have a disagreement, I will go to you and say to that, and then if it doesn't work, you need a higher authority, and this hearing becomes the higher authority. So, and the fact that we give the warning first to correct the situation, I'm comfortable with that, and I like that that's in there now. I don't know about the idea about using an ex-policeman or not, but I think you can use your discretion, you know, an ex-principal, you know, an ex-counselor, someone who is even, and I think that the city manager would find that person. And then the last thing was, I don't think the ordinance excludes the officer from being president. I think it's an option, isn't it? Or it doesn't say that you only have to do the report.
Yes. The report is the optional report, and if right. he is going to do a long report, which in most instances it's just going to be the administrative citation, then he will have to be present. And I cannot imagine the citation person not being there. Whenever we go down to court, the officer, whoever wrote the citation, has to be there to testify as to what he saw and what he did.
Okay. Bill?
I think you just answered the question. Say the person who receives a citation is not happy, probably not, with the hearing officer's ruling and does take it to municipal court. Is that proceeding, I think the officer has to be there, or is the municipal court judge going to, or the traffic officer, or whoever the person there is, just going to look at the written documents and make a decision?
That writ, and you asked me earlier, would, I believe the fee, if it hasn't changed, would cost the person $128 to file that, and that actually then is a case, John Doe versus City of Morro Bay, and now we are the defendant upholding that citation and that writ, so that the officer would have to show up to court on that day.
Are there the typical rules of discovery and all of that, and the ability of John Doe to ask the officer questions? Or
yes, definitely, and the cross examination occurs. There's limited discovery also in writs, though. It usually is left up to the parties how much discovery is allowed and not allowed. There's not depositions, and it's not a full blown trial, and it's not a writ does not involve a jury either.
To take this a little further, if the person who is cited loses there, is that it, or they, can they? Is there another appeal process?
You could then go to the appellate court.
Okay. Thank you.
Melody? Okay. I don't think that this is taking away anybody's rights. It's giving them another level. It starts local. I think that any discussion that would happen here, first of all, the warning hopefully would be sufficient in itself. The fact that, okay, here's this violation, it's been noted, it is a legitimate complaint, and please correct it. So as long as you respond to that, you're fine. If you don't have a concern, then, okay, you want to fight it, so you fight it locally first, then you can fight it, allow some control over what is happening when it does become a problem. And that's the only time we're going to hear about it, is when it becomes a real problem. And it's happened, and it is happening. So I think this is a way to address that a little bit more locally, a little bit more gently, and I would entertain a motion. Oh, I am happy with moving that to superseded instead of repealed, though. I like that wording better. So...
Madam Mayor, I'll make the motion. I move that we adopt Ordinance 530, adding Chapter 1.03 of Section 1 to the Morro Bay Municipal Code pertaining to administrative citation program, as presented to us by the City Attorney, with the change of the last word in the document from repealed to superseded. I'm sorry, it's not the last section. Section 4, the last word.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None.
Madam Mayor, this is Ordinance 530, an ordinance of the City of Morro Bay adding Chapter 1.03 to the Morro Bay Municipal Code relating to an administrative citation program.
Okay, moving on to one more public hearing, and that is adoption of Ordinance 532, amending the section regarding construction hours on weekends.
And that's one we'll have to...
Oh, that right, but... It is a public hearing. Don't we have to open it anyway?
or not?
It wasn't noticed properly, so.
Okay, so we don't have to open it at all.
And it'll
okay.
be on in the first meeting in August.
All right, so this will be on our August 13th meeting. Okay. All right, then I would ask the council to allow us to skip ahead to D1 because the lady who's making that presentation is not feeling her best, and I think Janine's going to be doing a lot of the talking for her. And this is the Morro Bay Dial-A-Ride Transportation Development Act Triennial Performance Audit Report.
Thank you. It's a very long title. It's a lot of review by the auditor. Basically, what this is a three-year audit that's required by the Transportation Development Act to occur, and it covers a three-year period ending June 30th of 2006. What the audit does is look at the past 3 years, and there's various performance statistics and whatnot that are looked at and reviewed along with operating costs and revenue, fare box ratio, to determine how efficient and effective the transit system is being. Also, part of the audit includes recommendations for the city to implement over the next 3 years during the next audit period, which are designed to help improve upon the existing efficiencies and effectiveness of the system, kind of springboarding forward to being more efficient and effective. Tonight we have Ann Lawler here from Lawler Consulting. She is the auditor who performed the three-year performance audit, and she's going to make a very brief presentation. Some of the slides that she's going to be going through are in your agenda packet, so you could follow along, as well as she, I think, has them up on the board as well. And what I'd like to do is turn it over to her for her brief presentation and then back over to council for any questions or comments you may have.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Mayor, members of the council. Continues to provide an essential transportation service in the city of Morro Bay. The city has been very successful in keeping the cost of the service down. The system remains a very productive and efficient service when compared with other dial-a-ride services in the county. And the trolley is also operating efficiently. The slides that now follow, give us a little, oh dear. I thought he said, there we go. Okay. The last audit had 10 recommendations, and 9 of those recommendations have been either implemented or are no longer needed. They're no longer relevant. There's only one remaining recommendation, and that's to provide a relief driver during the lunch breaks. And that I retained that recommendation in this audit as well. Findings of the current audit. This first part I'm going to talk about compliance, and this is important. Compliance, the Morro Bay Dial-A-Ride is in full compliance with 10 of the 12 regulatory requirements. You're out of compliance with the state submittal deadlines for the annual TDA fiscal audit, which is due 180 days after the end of the fiscal year. And for the most part, the system's data collection methodologies and reporting are in compliance with the state's requirement. The city is also in substantial compliance with the requirement that your retirement fund be 100% funded for 40 years into the future. You're about 85% funded. The major findings on the performance of the audit, on the performance audit, why isn't this working? For the period, I don't know why this isn't working. The operating cost increased 20.4%, and the fare revenues increased 40.4%. The fare revenue increase was due to the implementation of the fare increases that were adopted in July 2005 and the establishment of a premium fare for the Saturday service. The fare box ratio is very important because it's a measure of the efficiency of the system. And the Morro Bay Dial-A-Ride fare box ratio increased from 11.3 in 2002-03 to 13.3 in 2005-06. And the minimum requirement is 10%, so you're operating very well in terms of recovering on your fare box ratio. In terms of productivity, your productivity increased in terms of passengers per vehicle hour 3.2% over the three-year period for the passengers per vehicle service miles. Slight decrease, but nothing to worry about. The operating cost per vehicle service hour increased 25.8%. This is kind of comparable to many of the other systems, and part of that has to do with the fact that you have increased fuel costs. I reviewed the functions of the cities and their various operating, and the city management analyst is very efficient and effective in her transit management functions. I found that the mechanics files were very organized. The preventive maintenance, inspection, and repairs were thoroughly documented. The city has a very effective preventive maintenance inspection program. I would like to also compliment the contractor, MV Transportation. In the last audit, which I also performed, the contractor management reports there were a lot of errors in them. The date of reporting was very much more accurate this time. And the last thing that I thought was very important was that the high driver turnover rate that was experienced in the prior audit period has stabilized. There are seven recommendations of the audit, but I'm only going to cover two of them. The first is something that I mentioned a minute ago. That's that the annual TDA fiscal and compliance audit by the state required deadline. It's required that it be submitted by 180 days after the end of the fiscal year. That hasn't been happening. That's very, very critical for compliance with the state TDA. The second one is to ensure that the fiscal auditor correctly calculates the operating costs. Currently, the fiscal audits have been including the RTA contribution and all capital costs of the system within the operating costs. What that does is that overstates your operating costs and it throws off your fare box ratio calculation. So that's something that doesn't comply with the state's definition of operating costs. The capital costs are supposed to be excluded, and the RTA contribution is for the regional system, routes 12 and 11. I'm going to skip through these. I'm going to Morro Bay Trolley now. Morro Bay Trolley is operating very efficiently. Over the last three-year period, ridership did drop 16%. However, you also had a drop in tourism during the period. There was a decrease in both vehicle service hours and vehicle service miles. Those were because of service cuts, because of the ridership drop, and because of budget cuts. The fare increased 85%, and that's because of the fare increase that you adopted in May 2005. And as a result, the fare box recovery ratio increased dramatically from 11.6% to 21%. That's a very high fare box ratio recovery. We do have three recommendations for the trolley. However, I will not go through those tonight. If you had any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
I have a few questions.
Okay. Of the auditor or of staff.
I'm not sure. I say the first one, and you can say who, maybe. The reason for the decrease, maybe this is more staff in ridership. It's been coming back up, but hasn't
That's
quite.
Correct.
Is that because of the school?
Of the fare increase. However, it is now on the increase again.
Okay.
The ridership is now recovered almost to the same level that it was prior to the fare increase.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think my next question is for Janine. Janine.
Okay, let's see. Are there any other questions for the auditor so that she can sit down?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, you have it.
The application, I thought that the slow call granted us, at least was it a terminal grant for the lunchtime driver?
During the audit period, that item had not been implemented yet because of funding.
Mm-hmm.
Last fiscal year, the city applied for a state discretionary state transit assistance monies from the Council of Governments to provide for the lunch coverage that's talked about in the recommendations. So since the audit period, the city secured funding for this fiscal year to provide that coverage. At the end of that fiscal year, we're still going to be looking for funding to continue that, whether we have funding available in the existing TDA that we receive or whether we need to try to find another grant or some other means.
But the same grant won't be available?
My understanding is that the funding that we were looking at and received was a one-time infusion of STA money that was being received by the region.
And then under the recommendations, the first one, which the auditor pointed out, was complying with the PUC submittal of audits. Why has that not been happening?
During the audit period, the city's auditor for the citywide mm-hmm. Operating budget was having some internal organizational issues that were going on, resulting in the city audits not being completed in a timely fashion. Mm-hmm. And this trickled down to the TDA auditor, who couldn't start that audit until a particular portion of the TDA components within the city audit had been completed. So with the city auditor not being able to finish on mm-hmm. time, the TDA auditor couldn't start on time, and the city wasn't able to submit within the 180 days.
And that's fine. I get that connect now. I didn't understand how one auditor was related to the other.
Right. And we are finance has informed me that the issues that were with the city auditor have since been resolved, so mm-hmm. we're not expecting that the 06-07 budget should have the same issues, that mm-hmm. that budget should be done, or the audit for that should be done on time so the TDA auditor mm-hmm. can start on time. So we're not anticipating that this is going to be a continuing issue, mm-hmm. and I've been told by the finance director that if the city auditor troubles still continue, that we'll be getting a new auditor.
Another recommendation was the purchase of the software equipment. Did we not apply for that this last round when we got the lunch driver, or that's going to be coming up?
We have not in the past looked at funding a dispatching software program. Mm-hmm. This would be something that we could apply for the regular Rural Transit Fund grant, which happens once a year. So there is a possibility of getting that anywhere from 80 to 100.
And I'm sure that was the basis for the recommendation to receive and file the report.
Okay. Thank you.
Bill?
Just a quick comment. Have any of you ever been in the Dial-A-Ride office when they've been busy?
Yes.
There are more little pieces of paper floating around in there, and I have nothing but admiration for anybody that could sit there at that phone and figure out where those papers are going.
And they know.
And it translates so smoothly to the other end, but... I have, as I say, nothing but admiration for considering the procedure, how that works.
Melody?
A question for Janine. You've probably heard a lot of comments about the trolley brochure and the need to update it. It's recommendation number 2 back here on page 10 of the audit. Is there any progress being done with that, or... do you need assistance with anything like that?
Well, this is also echoing an earlier recommendation from the North Coast Transit Plan, the 5-year update that occurred earlier this year. And it's something that we're currently working on. The Chamber of Commerce or the Community Promotions Committee, there's a few people that are working on a map of the area that would have certain things on it that they would then forward to the city, and we would be able to put the trolley routes and stops on there as well. There's also the issue with the potential for adding the third trolley route as a result of some of the things that were going on with the parking management plan. Mm-hmm. So certain things can get done now that won't exactly be as pretty as we'd like to have them, so that we could get the information out there in map form. And then as we work towards next season, with getting the third route added, and there's going to be changes very likely to the existing Route 1 and possibly with the new route, that's where we would focus, having the new brochure with all that information in graphic form. We do have on the city's website in the trolley area, there used to just be a written description of the various trolley stops. There's now the ability to link to a Google map that shows those spots on a citywide map. So that's inching forward towards completing the North Coast recommendation, as well as what was talked about during the parking management plan, and we'll work towards the recommendation that's here.
Yeah, because I favored that other trolley route, but I keep seeing the trolley running empty, and or with one or two people. A couple of times over this 4th of July weekend, it was full. So I think we need to work on really getting the stops identified on the website and as a brochure, which takes me to this third one about the trolley tokens that maybe local hotels can buy or restaurants. Is that a thing that we're working on?
We've always had a program where whether it's hotels, restaurants, businesses could purchase tokens at a discount, and then they can either sell them for the full fare price to the patrons or just hand them out as kind of a gift for coming into the store or the restaurant. And we've had a few businesses over the years, a couple of hotels doing that, and I think it's something that they
want. He's always trying to get people to participate in that. I don't know, Janine, when we talked today, you were going to see if you could find out what the cost of that dispatch software was in Atascadero. Did you get a chance to contact them?
I did. I spoke with Valerie Humphrey with the city of Atascadero, and they have a situation similar to ours, and they have a very small dial-a-ride system. I think they only have two vehicles like we do. They have a much larger area, but in terms of they had previously been doing the manual dispatching with the little teeny tiny tickets all over the place, and they had the same day service, demand response service that we do, and they went with a system that she was saying it was about $17,000 for the software program. It's not a GPS service, so there's no mobile data terminals on the vehicle or vehicle locators that transmit data to the program. It's simply for dispatching. So this is something that we can pursue grants for, and it's something that can help with the productivity for the dispatchers when they're on the phone. I was talking a little bit with Valerie Humphrey about how did the dispatchers like it. Are they able to get information quicker and get through their calls quicker so that another person can call in and schedule a ride? And she was saying that is exactly what's happening. Once you go through that adjustment period at the very beginning where you're getting everybody's information inputted, once that's inputted, the call time goes it shortens quite a bit, so they're able to take more calls and be more efficient, effective. Also helps with reporting, where a lot of things are being done manually and then entered into a computer program. They're now kind of there already in the system.
Okay. And then on number 5 on the dial-a-ride, we had adopted some new standards with the North Coast Transit Plan, and I'm thinking maybe we shouldn't have, because that's working to our detriment, I think.
Well, what had happened, as was mentioned by Ann Lawler in response to a question about the ridership decrease on Dial-A-Ride, the closure of the elementary school back in 2000, 2001 did have a big impact to ridership. At that time, we were doing about maybe 15 trips a day to the elementary school, and they're what are called many-to-one trips, where you would go and you would pick up 10, 15 kids at their houses, but you would go to one location to drop all of them off. And so what that does is that increases your ridership productivity, because instead of going to 10 different spots and then 10 different spots, so what we've been seeing is that we've lost that many-to-one trip, and there's no other type of many-to-one trip that can replace it. So while
we can switch to Del Mar?
No, because a lot of the trips that were for were coming from Morro Elementary to Del Mar for after school type programs.
Okay.
And So we lost a lot of that ridership that we just can't replace in that same many-to-one fashion. And we can increase ridership, get 10 new riders, but they're going to be 10 individual places to 10 individual places, which doesn't ultimately help with your ridership productivity. So in talking with the auditor during this time, we kept thinking about maybe the
thing here that we would not like staff to come back and tell us how we could implement.
No, I would like staff to come back with the pros and cons of each recommendation.
Okay.
And I think that's 10 altogether. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long that will take her, but I assume it would be in the fall sometime, maybe September.
That sound good, Janine? Okay.
Madam Mayor, I also would hope that staff would, before we jump on that $17,000 software, would look around, because I don't know the vendor, but I have heard and seen demos of software that may or may not work that were a lot less money, that actually some of it would actually transmit the data by digital information to the vehicles rather than the dispatcher having to talk. I know there's more stuff out there all the time, and I don't necessarily have anything to do with it, but if you want, I could ask some of our suppliers to see what's available and then maybe give you some names you could call, because to me, considering it's just the dispatcher looking at a database, $17,000 is a lot of money for a database.
Okay.
I don't know that that needs to be a motion. I think.
Well, no, just a motion on all of it.
Well, we need a motion to receive and then to come back with recommendations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, go ahead. You're the one that wanted to do it. I'll second it.
Then I move that we receive and file the attached TDA triennial performance audit final audit report, and that we ask staff to come back in September with options or pros and cons on each of the 10 recommendations by our auditor, which did a lovely job. Thank you very much.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. Thank you so much, and I hope you feel better soon. All right, now, quick break? Okay, quick break, and we'll come back and look at tree things.